Hey, it's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, we'll find out why a pound of ground beef costs more than ever these days and what it means for consumers.
First, we're going to fact check something Governor Walker has been saying as he's traveled around the country in the run-up to his likely presidential bid. Here he is speaking about the Act 10 protests at the Iowa Freedom Summit in January.
You know, you all know about the protests. I mean, at one point, there were 100,000 or more protesters in and around our state capitol. They were banging on the drums. They were blowing the horns. They had signs and banners. I guess, in a way, I almost have to apologize because the Occupy movement started in Madison, Wisconsin 4 years ago and then went to Wall Street. So my apologies for that.
Governor Walker, they're suggesting that the Occupy movement, which got its name from the Occupy Wall Street protests in Manhattan's Zuccotti Park and spread to cities all over the country and the world, actually started in Wisconsin at the Capitol during the 2011 Act 10 protests.
Here with us now to talk about the history of the Occupy movement and what connection it might have to Wisconsin is David Meyer, professor of sociology and political science at the University of California, Irvine. He's the author of a number of books on social movements and protests. David, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be with you.
So let's follow that thread. Did the Occupy movement, in effect, start here in Madison?
No, but that's okay. Certainly activists in New York were paying attention to what was happening in Madison, and they took some inspiration from the people piling out into the streets, but they were also paying attention to the indignados in Spain. They were also paying attention to the Arab Spring. They talked about Tahrir Square much more than they talked about Madison. And boy, you know, in Tahrir Square, the activists toppled the government, which didn't really turn out that way in Madison. So I can understand why they took more inspiration from what was going on in Egypt. So, no, but people were paying attention to Madison for sure.
Is this often how protests work, especially in this day and age where you can follow, if you're in one protest movement, you can follow another one almost in real time, that there's this kind of inspiration and borrowing back and forth?
It's an amazing thing, and it used to be that you were dependent upon the mass media to get your message out. But as you know, people all around the world were watching Occupy Wall Street and even Madison on live streams on their computers. I had one student who was watching 20 images at the same time, 20 videos at the same time. Amazing that he was able to do anything else.
What were some of the tactical differences and similarities between what we saw in Wisconsin and what came later on in the Occupy movement?
Well, what happened in Wisconsin was largely about a fight against Governor Walker's attempt to take collective bargaining rights away from organized labor, his successful attempt to do so. And labor, the teachers' unions and other unions, were at the lead of what was happening in Madison in particular. And then other people joined in on that. In New York, there was some labor involved, but it was a much, much broader claim about inequality generally and political and economic inequality. And I think the message in Madison was narrower and much clearer, and it was definitely anti-Walker, but it was about collective bargaining and preserving labor rights in Spain. In New York City, it was about human services, it was about inequality, and it was sometimes diffuse and hard to make sense of what was going on.
There was criticism of Occupy and those other global movements you mentioned for being too diffuse, for people not really being able to get a handle on what people were talking about. But is that something that maybe gives a movement more staying power, allows it to grow and change with the times?
Well, this is the problem with democracy. If you believe that people should be making decisions about things that affect their lives, Occupy was very much committed to that, and they had a set of democratic processes that let everyone have their say. But from outside, it was hard for people who didn't want to make sense of it to make sense of it, to know what was most important. And, you know, there was, in honesty, some incoherence to it in that, you know, there were Ron Paul and the Fed supporters at Occupy Wall Street, too, who, you know, were not getting broad agreement from the other occupiers, but that was certainly a claim that they were making. So it's complicated and difficult. It's easier to send a message if everybody agrees on the same message. it's harder to stay engaged over the long haul, and it's harder to gather lots of people when the message is too narrow and people don't feel like they're making the decisions about things that affect their lives.
Talking to David Meyer from the University of California, Irvine. He's an expert on protests and social movements, talking about the extent to which the Occupy movement got its inspiration or not from protests here in Madison in 2011. Governor Walker on the campaign trail has said, hey, I had to deal as a governor with the original Occupy movement. So why would Governor Walker want, do you think, to make this connection, this narrative that Occupy had its first manifestation here in Wisconsin?
Well, Governor Walker is faced with the task of promoting what he's done in Wisconsin to the very conservative voters in Republican primaries in pursuit of his presidential ambitions. That means he has to have a record of success, and he certainly had a record of success in making life miserable for labor, but he has an interest in making that bigger and dealing with more national issues than it does to us on the face. So if instead of beating back local labor, he was actually responsible for fighting against a broad-based movement of inequality, well, that plays further in the Republican primary than just the anti-labor stuff. I mean, didn't Governor Walker also say that he's prepared for foreign policy and ISIS because he'd crushed labor? You know, he'd fought those teachers in Madison as well. I mean, this his major achievement is an anti-labor achievement, so he's trying to make that into as much as he possibly can for his conservative Republican primary voter audience.
So turning toward Occupy a little more closely now, as compared to what happened here in Madison, how did the Occupy movement first start in Zuccotti Park and then grow from there?
There are local activists in New York who were campaigning against Mayor Bloomberg and budget cuts and human service cuts that had been trying to foster a campaign. And they'd actually set an occupation in front of City Hall months before Occupy, and it had lasted for several days. People slept out. There'd been demonstrations in front of the mayor's house and Gracie Mansion. And then in the beginning of the summer, there was a call from Adbusters with that beautiful poster of the ballerina on top of the bull. It said, Occupy September 17th, Occupy Wall Street. And activists were a little skeptical, but they said, why don't we try it? And they staged what became the first demonstration in Zuccotti Park, and they slept out. And because they were able to stay, and because there was not another game in town, it was able to spread. And critical in all of this were activists in other cities picked up on the Occupy idea. And there was a huge, what we'd call a social control error, when New York City police arrested 754 people demonstrating on the Brooklyn Bridge, and that got national attention. So about 2 weeks after the occupation in Zuccotti Park started, it got much bigger as all kinds of activists poured into Zuccotti Park and poured into public spaces all over the United States. I'm sorry to drone on about this, but it's important to understand also that the occupations all over the country were a little bit different depending upon who was organized and who was leading it. In Salt Lake City, there was a huge focus on environmental issues. In Minnesota, in Minneapolis, St. Paul, there was a lot of focus on housing as an issue. So the occupations were all about political and economic inequality, but they took on a lot of local color.
Now, the protests in Wisconsin ended. There doesn't seem to be an overt movement following up on those. Occupy, you don't see in the news anyway. You don't see those occupations. Is there a continuing role, though, for these movements in politics today?
Well, nobody predicted that Occupy was going to take off when it did. So I'm not going to tell you that something like that won't emerge again. Occupy spilled out into all kinds of other causes. And if you, like, get online and start searching Occupy, you'll find Occupy student debt, Occupy foreclosure, Occupy Keystone, Occupy Hurricane Sandy, all kinds of other campaigns. It's harder, however, to see an overarching idea unifying all these campaigns. And, again, that's a problem with or the challenge that Occupy was dead set against being co-opted and letting some national organization set direction for all these local campaigns. So you got something that was hyper-democratic, but awfully hard to track and awfully hard to, you know, be strategic about.
So did it have a political effect, even if the movement itself isn't up and running? Did it sway political views, inequality messages that we've heard even from the president?
Well, one of the amazing things that happened is the discourse really, really did change about 2 months into Occupy. And it started with mainstream politicians picking up the rhetoric of the occupiers. So the idea, you know, some of it was just like joking, oh, I'm going to occupy this salad bar. But more seriously, you saw people talking about political and economic inequality and real economic opportunity in a much bigger way. You saw members of Congress take up these issues and see what kind of mileage they could get out of it. And President Obama, who had spent the years since the Tea Party election of 2010 just talking about the deficit and talking about the deficit and talking about spending, suddenly started talking about political and economic inequality. And in effect, that seeded the ground for this, you know, broad spectrum of attention that Thomas Piketty got when he published his book. So they reestablished inequality as an important issue in American politics. In terms of concrete policy gains, however, we're waiting.
Now, between Wisconsin, Occupy, Arab Spring, Ukraine, there were lots of protests for a while. Have we seen the end of a phase, of an era of protest globally?
God, I hope not. I mean, where's my career then? No, I mean, there's always new stuff, and everybody who predicts the end of an era historically has been wrong. But what we can't really predict is what are the issues that are going to be taken up and how is it going to relate to the policy process. What I've been watching and seen a lot of action on in both mainstream politics and at the grassroots is concern about student debt and concern about immigration. We've also seen, amazingly, and we shouldn't take this for granted, the last 20 years on gay and lesbian rights have been phenomenal in terms of the scope and pace of political change. You know, I was thinking about those local pizza places in Madison that got a windfall during the Madison occupation, where people all over the United States who were sympathetic with the protesters were buying pizzas for them. And then pizza was again in the news in Indiana when conservatives were raising money for this one pizza place that refused to cater a gay wedding. You know, my daughter said, pizza at a wedding? Be serious.
David, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks for joining us today.
Okay, thank you. Take care.
That's David Meyer, professor of sociology and political science at the University of California, Irvine, talking about the history of the Occupy movement in light of Governor Walker's suggestion that began in Wisconsin during the Act 10 protests.
If you've been in the meat aisle of your grocery store recently, you may have experienced a bit of sticker shock when it comes to the price of beef.
According to the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics, prices of ground beef have been steadily climbing in recent years, now at record highs, with a pound of ground beef averaging around $4.24, up 90% from 5 years ago.
So the question here is why? Brenda Botel joins us now. She's an agricultural economics professor and associate dean at the University of Wisconsin River Falls. Brenda, thanks so much for joining us.
Nice to be here. Thanks.
Well, first of all, how high are beef prices right now?
Oh, they are record high. If you look at an average for retail prices, you know, on our retail prices of all fresh beef for between January and February, they increased another 5 cents. And that might not seem that much, but when you stop and think, that's almost 15% higher than where we were at a year ago at this time. That's our all fresh beef prices. That's a pretty significant increase.
How does that compare with other meat on the market right now?
Well, other meat on the market is not increasing. When we're looking at poultry and pork prices, those are declining somewhat. And so where we're seeing is that we're getting this wider spread between beef and pork prices and beef and poultry prices, and that's just continuing to get larger.
So we've got these beef prices at record highs. Why do you see that being the case right now?
Well, it's you've got two situations, two things that are affecting it. One, we have less decline or less beef production, especially when we compare it to increases in pork production and poultry production. So we have steady to slower amounts of beef production, but we also have strong demand for beef. And so those two things can individually, they can lead to increased prices. And then when you have both of them, that's going to lead to these really strong beef prices.
So to tackle one of those strands you talked about, production being down, why is production down right now?
Well, basically, you've got several things that have occurred over the last several years. You know, so in the cattle industry, we've looked at and tried to say that as a cattle industry in general for the United States, we've tried and there's been incentive to grow the cattle herd, but we haven't been able to, starting even from back in, going back to 2011. We had drought in the southern parts of the United States, which is where a large part of beef production is at. So we had that drought there, which led to culling of many cows. Then we had a widespread drought in 2012, which again led to producers not really even having forage and pasture in order to be able to keep animals. And then because of that drought, then we also saw extremely high grain prices. So those things for the last several years has made it so that it's very hard to grow. There hasn't been, even though there's been a desire to, it's been hard biologically to grow that beef herd in the United States. Now we've gotten to the point where we're hopefully Mother Nature's agreeing and there's incentive there from an economic viewpoint to be able to grow this herd. But then we have a biological aspect. As we start growing that herd, what that means is that we have heifers that aren't going to go into feedlots anymore. And so then that means there's actually less animals being finished. And so for a while, we will have less beef production.
We're talking about the record high prices of beef right now with Brenda Patel from Wisconsin University of Wisconsin River Falls. And you talked a lot about drought there, and we have been seeing a lot of erratic weather in recent years, you know, looking at California imposing some water restrictions right now. Now, they may not be a huge beef-producing state, but an indication perhaps of things to come. So if we continue to see dry weather, are we going to continue to have trouble with beef prices?
Well, if we have dry weather and it's widespread, it makes it more challenging, exactly, especially when we're looking at forages, you know, because we even animals that are finished on grain in the United States, they spend a large majority of their life in the pasture and on forages. And so we still need to have pasture land and forages available for those animals until they get into that feed yard. And if we have widespread drought, that makes that challenging to find that.
Now, is there a tipping point in all this where the price of beef could get so high that eventually that would kill off the demand? People develop different eating habits, maybe.
Well, and to be honest, and that's where I say demand is strong. On the one hand, it's kind of, we've reached this point, and I'm an economist, so I've been saying that for a while, that I keep thinking we're going to get to the point where the beef prices are so high and we will get pushback from consumers. We haven't yet seen that, and in fact, actually, the cutout prices for wholesale beef have actually gone up, even though the amount has gone down, which is, I mean, has gone up as well, excuse me. And so that's kind of an anomaly. What that's saying is that, to me, as an economist, I'm looking at that and going, there still is a very strong demand for beef. We like beef in the United States. You know, I mean, we are beef consuming, and I mean, my idea is that, you know, eventually we'll have to hit this threshold price where people do push back, but we haven't seen it. I think the thing is, maybe those who already, because there's this widespread now, I mean, if you look at all fresh beef prices, the difference between all fresh beef prices and pork. So if you go back to 2000, that difference between that price was 50 cents. Now we're near a little over $2. That difference. And so I think is that we probably have seen some of those who are already going to switch, who are more price sensitive, have already made that switch from beef to other protein products. Now we have the people who are going to be a little less price sensitive, and so they're not going to make that switch until that price reaches extreme levels. Another aspect you have to think about with beef prices that helps the beef price stay higher is that when the economy is doing well, we tend to eat beef, and a beef gets a lot of its value from eating in restaurants, from the consumption of the beef in a restaurant. We eat a lot of beef at home, but that tends to be more of the hamburger, which is a lower-valued beef product. We eat those middle meats and those steaks in restaurants, and that tends to be that higher valued, higher-priced beef product. Right now in the United States, we are still seeing restaurant performance index has been 24 months where it's been above 100, which means that we are in an expansion phase for restaurants. That's an extreme amount of time. So people are going out to eat. They're feeling somewhat comfortable, at least in that way. And so we're still seeing beef on menus, and that helps keep that beef price high as well.
And Brenda, just briefly, is this good news or bad news for the state's beef farmers that the price is so high right now?
Well, it's very, when you say beef farmer, you've got two different producers there. And so on the one hand, even though the beef price is high, if you are a feedlot producer, they are not making money right now. And in fact, actually, they're probably, if we look at the feedlot margin, they're probably in one of the worst situations that they've been for a very long period of time. Because even though they're getting higher prices for their finished animal, because we have such a shortage of those calves to yearlings to those feeder animals that we're going to place on feed, they're having to pay such very high prices for those to begin with to feed them out. They're actually not making money right now.
And we leave it there. Brenda, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
That was Brenda Battelle. She's an agricultural economics professor and associate dean at the University of Wisconsin River Falls. She joined us to talk about the rising price of beef in the United States.
First, we're getting the latest news on the police shooting of an unarmed black man in Madison about a month ago.
On March 6th, Madison police officer Matt Kenny shot and killed 19-year-old Tony Robinson on Madison's east side. Because the shooting involved police, Wisconsin law dictates an outside agency conduct an investigation into the incident. Tony Robinson's family initially said they trusted the state investigation, but at a press conference yesterday, their spokesperson said they'd lost faith in the process.
Nico Savage is here with us to talk about yesterday's conference and the latest news surrounding this investigation. Nico Savage is a crime and police reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. Nico, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
So as we mentioned, there's this press conference yesterday with Tony Robinson's family and a friend, a spokesperson. What did they say at this conference?
Well, there were a couple of points that they wanted to make at the press conference. Jerome Flowers was a family spokesman speaking on behalf of the family. Tony Robinson's mother was standing beside him out in front of the Dane County Courthouse on yesterday, which marked a month since the shooting. Basically, the two big points that they touched on were that the family does not believe that the investigation into the March 6th shooting is fair, and that they also would like to see the officer involved, Officer Matt Kinney. They want to see criminal charges filed against him by Dane County's district attorney. Currently, that case is being reviewed by the DA's office. It's been there since March 27th, and there's been no kind of announcement as far as a timeline for when any sort of decision might be made. But the family now says that it does want to see criminal charges filed against the officer involved.
And that seems to be a change of message. Previously, they said, let's let this investigation go through. There seemed to be some trust from the family,
right.
family anyway, in this process. Did they give an indication of why that has changed?
Well, yeah, you're right. It is a change from previous statements the family's made. Last month, you had Robinson's mother saying that she did have faith in that investigation, and the family saying that they couldn't say yet if they believed he should. It's in part because they say that they don't believe the investigation is truly impartial. So what they say is that the Madison Police Department was allowed to pick the Division of Criminal Investigation, the state agency that's investigating it, and they say that MPD has assisted in the investigation. And to them, they believe that while that might be within the letter of the state law that requires those outside investigations, they believe it's not truly independent. Now, the police department has been quick to point out throughout this process that they're not the ones kind of leading that investigation, right? That it is being led by state investigators, that it's in their hands. But family members and activists with the Young, Gifted, and Black Coalition, they also said yesterday that they, as for all intents and purposes, don't see a difference between the Division of Criminal Investigation and the Madison Police Department, because those are all law enforcement agencies. That's why the group has basically tried to seek some outside relief from the United Nations.
That's right. There's a petition asking the United Nations to investigate this shooting and Madison more generally, and the United States more generally, when it comes to these issues. What are they calling for in this petition?
Right. So this petition has about 1,100 signatures online. It calls for an investigation from the United Nations Human Rights Council, the Organization of American States. It's also addressed to the Secretary of State, John Kerry. It calls for an investigation of the shooting of Tony Robinson, as well as one into the broader issue of racial disparities in Madison and Dane County.
Now, can you set the scene for us? Just describe what the mood was like at this conference and a small protest that led up to it.
Right. So, like I said, Monday marked 1 month since the shooting. The protesters gathered at the home on Williamson Street where Robinson was shot. They then marched behind a banner reading Black Lives Matter from that home up to the Dane County Courthouse, where Jerome Flowers, the family spokesman, addressed reporters and addressed the crowd out in front of the courthouse. About 50 people were taking part, obviously not as big as some of the biggest demonstrations that have happened, but you also had protest leaders there from Young, Gifted, and Black, who said that whenever the decision is announced, and whether that decision is that the officer will or won't face charges, that they want people to gather, people who are supportive of their cause, to gather at the home on Williamson Street for demonstrations and whatever might come, demonstrations that will follow that. So,
talking to Nico Savage from the Wisconsin State Journal about the latest in a police-involved shooting in Madison. And now you mentioned watching for the decision on whether or not to indict the officer involved. The district attorney, Dane County District Attorney Ismael Ozan,
right,
has gotten the results of the outside investigation from the State Division of Criminal Investigation. Do we have a timeline on when he will make the decision to indict or not?
Well, we do not. Like I said, that investigation has been with the district attorney's office since March 27th. It is currently under review. You know, when we've talked with Madison police officials, they say that they think, and they're very clear in reiterating that they don't know, that this is just what they think, that it would take at least 2 weeks after the district attorney first got those results in order to get toxicology results from Tony Robinson. But then also, you know, if you think about it, it's probably a huge report. You know, we've heard hundreds of pages is something that the family's attorney has mentioned. And the state DCI report is not the only one they'll be looking at. There's also medical examiner reports and toxicology, like I mentioned. So a lot of information to go through. The district attorney hasn't given any indication of when a decision will come. But MPD and I know some other agencies have basically asked for about a 24 hours heads up before that decision is announced, so that they can get, you know, people ready to go, and so that they can also, I believe, reach out to kind of community leaders and that sort of thing and get them prepared for what may or may not be coming.
On the other side of things here, we've seen documents released by the police department, not directly pertaining to this investigation, but related to Tony Robinson's family, to the house in which this happened, and to the officer's past. Can you talk about that a little?
Sure. So these documents, hundreds of pages of them, were released Friday afternoon. Now, the family of Tony Robinson, they took issue with this. They basically said that it boiled down to an attempt to kind of try him in the eyes of the public because they're releasing information on previous law enforcement contacts that he was involved in. And they're also pointing out that those, you know, those prior contacts and those records, that those don't have anything to do with the shooting that happened on March 6th. And indeed, police did not release records from the shooting itself. What the records covered was everything from Officer Kenny's personnel file, reports about a 2007 officer-involved shooting in which Officer Kenny killed a 48-year-old man but was later exonerated in that. Also, like I mentioned, and like you mentioned, prior police contacts at 1125 Williamson Street, prior police contacts with Tony Robinson. So MPD says that all of these documents that they released had been requested either by reporters or others under state open records law. So that what they say is they're not, you know, doing this to attempt to make any, and the chief wrote about this on his blog yesterday, not trying to cast any dispersions on Tony Robinson. They're trying to comply with open records laws, is what the department says. And indeed, in those records, you know, you see there have been a number of police contacts with Tony Robinson, but in the vast majority of cases, he's either listed as, you know, a victim. There are cases that involve him as a child and domestic disputes between his parents. Either that, or there are cases where he is a witness. And then there is also the 2014 conviction that was on his record for armed robbery, and a lot of information about that. But, you know, definitely a mix, and the family says they're concerned that it's being painted as, a number of law enforcement contacts that he's had over his life.
And one last wrinkle now in this story, the family of Tony Robinson asking the DA to view results of a private autopsy.
Right.
So is there, does this usually happen? Is this something that a DA might usually look at, or is this a case where nothing is as usual in this story?
Sure. Well, you know, I'm honestly not sure if that's something that he would consider. I know that it's something that the family is asking for. Their attorney says that autopsy was done in just a couple of weeks ago at UW Hospital, but the family has not really said what new information is going to come from that. They say that there is new information there that hasn't been previously reported or previously given to the DA, and that they want to give that information to them. I haven't said exactly what that will be. It'll be interesting to see. They basically want the DA to meet with them and to discuss the results of that private autopsy before releasing his decision, or making his decision, I should say, on whether or not to charge the officer.
Now, this story got obviously captured the attention in the immediate Madison area, a lot in Wisconsin, and was the focus of some national news, just given similar stories around the country. Do you sense that that's going to return when this decision from the DA to indict or not comes out?
I think that's a good question. It'll sort of depend on what we see here. I think one reason why there was obviously that, well, we know why there was the immediate attention on it, right? All of the other incidents that have involved police killing black men across America. However, I think one of the reasons why we saw that dissipate was, frankly, that there was not the sort of continuing drama here that you had in a place like Ferguson, right? You had Ferguson each night. You had police and protesters squaring off, and the possibilities of violence, and the possibilities of police using force to quell those demonstrations. Well, you didn't really see that here in Madison, right? You had peaceful protests, no reports of property damage or arrests, that kind of thing, in the immediate aftermath. But of course, as we get into to what's going to happen after the decision is released, we're not really sure. The protest leaders from Young, Gifted, and Black expressed some frustration with the way that's been talked about in the media. Basically, what they said is you know, they are being repeatedly asked, will there be violence after the decision is announced? And what they pointed out is that no one from their organization has been talking about violence. What they say is that it's police who are being violent toward African Americans in Dane County, and they say it's an attempt to kind of frame the issue or to reframe it as the possibility of violence from people who are upset over the outcome.
Nico, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Nico Savage, crime and police reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. He was with us to talk about the latest news surrounding the investigation into the police shooting of Tony Robinson. Last night, in a gut-wrenching finish, the Badgers lost to Duke in that 68-63 game in the NCAA men's basketball finals. Some controversy about a referee's call in the second half. I was yelling at the TV a little. The Badgers had a decent lead at one point, but the game went down to the Blue Devils.
We're taking your calls now. How did this game go down with you? What do you want to tell the Badgers now that their season is over? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is how the game went down last night. 3 seconds on the clock. Missed shot by the Badgers that wouldn't have tied it up at that point, even if it had fallen.
Bounces out to Koenig with 3 seconds. He's going to run out of time, and the Blue Devils are the national champions of 2015.
Lots of sad faces in Wisconsin about that game. Sad Wisconsin Teletubbies on CBS last night. Tears, disbelief from fans and players, but a pretty amazing season of Badger basketball.
Now, we know that probably nobody is more bummed out than the Badgers themselves. So what would you want to tell them about what you think about this incredible season of basketball? It's your chance to say thanks, remember your favorite moments, and celebrate. And also, what was your experience like watching that game last night? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Let's go to a caller. We've got Jamie on the line in Green Bay. Jamie, hi.
Hi. So, yeah, what a heartbreaker, huh?
Yeah.
I just want to say to the team, I think, you know, even though it had to be hard to end the season that way, I think what I'm more sad about today, you know, even the loss, is just not watching this team anymore on and off the court. You know, we're not going to hear about Nigel Hayes stumping stenographers at press conferences, or seeing, you know, the fun locker room dances, or hearing Bo Ryan talk about how he was a pinball wizard, you know, back in the day. I think, you know, that the players brought out a looseness in him as well. And they were just, you know, just a fine young bunch of men to watch, both on and off the court, and just a joy. And I think that's what I'll miss. So I want to thank them for just such an awesome season.
Jamie, thanks so much for getting us started. Thanks for your call.
And we'll go next to Matt, joining us from the Menominee Reservation. Matt, hi.
Hi. I would just like to say it was a successful season. You know, like we beat Kentucky. Nobody thought that we would get past them. All the prognosticators never thought we would get that far. You know, they were picking Duke and Kentucky in the final. We got to the final.
So, some great moments there. And beating Kentucky is something to go home on for sure. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for that, Matt. Appreciate your call.
We're taking your calls. Your reactions, what were you thinking through that game last night, the final, the NCAA basketball final? Your thoughts on the Badgers' season. Now, your well wishes, if you want, for the team. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Back to our callers now, Jerome in Mequon now. Jerome, hi.
Hi. For the Badger fans who were saddened by the way the Badgers ended up last night, it should remind them that there were 68 teams in this tournament, and there are 66 other teams who would have been delighted if they had ended up where the Badgers ended up.
Jerome, thanks a lot for the call. And, of course, that they're all the teams that didn't make the tournament at all. So, yeah, I think, yeah, that is a great point, that they really hit a high point, and they were in that game. I mean, they had a real fighting chance to win that thing. Thank you so much, Jerome, for your call.
And we'll go next to Nick. Nick joins us from Dubuque. Nick, hi.
Hi, calling from Dubuque, Iowa, and just wanted to say how proud I was to be a Badger fan. It was really a testament, I think, to Coach Ryan, his staff, and all those kids to show a bona fide college basketball program with real student athletes could compete against NBA developmental-type squad. So really cool to see, just proud to be a Badger fan.
Great. Nick expressing what a lot of people have said, proud to be a Badger fan. I saw a funny little graph from Nate Silver, the statistician, saying that the people who were happy that Duke won was this tiny sliver limited to Raleigh-Durham. Everyone else, red for Badgers.
Duke is the team that a lot of people love to hate, I think. You can still join in with your thoughts on the Badgers' season, their finals game last night, 800-642-1234. Kim next in Milwaukee. Kim, hi there.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just want to shout out to the team, to everybody. You guys did a great job. Don't look down on yourselves. You got there all the way. I'm not a basketball fan. I do not watch the game at all, but I always want my teams to win, and I'm glad they got at least there. You know, like the other caller said, we weren't supposed to beat the Wild Kittens. That's what I call them, and the Wildcats, and I'm glad they did that, and I'm proud of them. I'm proud of all of them. So hoo-hoo to us. Thank you.
Thanks,
very
Kim.
Much. Have a great day.
All right, thanks for that. On to Dan in Franksville. Hi, Dan.
Yeah, well, they did a good job and stuff like that. More importantly, to me, it seems that they're just looking at them. I don't know much about them personally, but their personalities as a group, as far as I can tell, they're really beautiful people. Their futures are going to be more important, just the fact that they're going to be in our society with us. It's good to know that there's wonderful, beautiful people like them that are young are going to be part of our society. And it's just, you know, I don't look good or bad. What's important is just them as a personality, as people.
That's a great place to leave it. Dan, thank you so much for that. Thanks for everyone for your comments. And don't forget, you can keep this conversation going over on the Central Time Facebook page.
The State Division of Juvenile Corrections is trying a new approach to dealing with troubled teens. On a few acres just outside of Madison, a dozen juvenile offenders are learning to grow their own food while they earn a high school diploma. In part two of a series on gardening and restorative justice, Gilman Halstead reports on the Grow Academy.
Potatoes, radishes, kale, mustard, some other stuff.
Walking through the one-acre garden plot in a field above the dormitory where he will live for 6 months, 14-year-old Sterling proudly lists off the vegetables he'll be planting once the ground warms up enough. There's a row of fruit tree saplings at the edge of the garden plot. Jenica Skaug from the nonprofit group Community Groundworks is teaching a group of teens how to prune the branches.
There we go.
Can I cut this one?
Nope, that's a good one. We want to leave that one. We want to just look for anything that's broken or dead or crossing each other. And this one might not actually have any.
This one is crossing.
It might, but I think we can leave it until next year.
This one will grow to all up here.
Let's wait till next year. I think this tree actually might be pretty good. I don't think we need to do much else on this tree.
This time of year, much of the agri-science curriculum the Grow Academy uses is taught in the classroom, where students have built platforms out of old bunk beds and mounted grow lights for getting onions and pea seedlings started. Pointing to a large calendar on the wall, Skaug says it's also where they're taught when to plant what.
What does the average last frost date mean? So the last day that we would expect to have a frost in Madison. So some things we can plant before the frost, and some things we have to wait until after that last frost. And then they had to kind of put it together like a puzzle based on this date. And they got where everything is. And then as we do things, we've been crossing them off and writing the actual date that we did things.
It's a hands-on approach to teaching math and science skills. Kate Elvidge, the regional director for juvenile corrections, says it's based on research done on the effectiveness of horticulture therapy.
A lot of these kids, they don't function well in traditional classrooms where it's lecture style. And so they tend to learn more by doing things.
And Elvidge says it appears to be working well.
When you see them planting the seeds, they grumble about it, and because it's work. But then when they see the plants start growing and their fruits start coming, they're really actually proud of what they're doing. And when we have tours in the summer, they're right out there at their garden, you know, showing off what they've planted, what they're growing. When their families come, they're able to harvest things.
Elvidge says the garden is also used to teach nutrition and cooking skills. Last month, the 8 students in the program held an Iron Chef-style contest to see who could cook the best dinner, incorporating some of the produce from the garden. The program also includes field trips to commercial kitchens to learn skills that might lead to a food service job.
Many of them return to this community, so to be able to make those connections with potential employers of places that they're gaining experience from here is really a benefit.
And there's also a restorative justice component. Each week, Academy students serve a meal to the homeless at a local food pantry.
We feel like it's a good opportunity, a good exposure for them, and a chance for them to give back to the community. And so all of these activities really are them practicing to show people that they don't have to be incarcerated, that they can, you know, choose a different path when they leave here.
The Academy is only in its second year, but already they have plans to sell some of the produce from the garden at one of Madison's farmers markets this year. Gilman Halstead, Wisconsin Public Radio.